Okay, so my name's Amol Gavadra, and Surya Vangsar, a few times in the past, has said, why don't you pop to Dhanakosha? And he said, Ellen, this year, because he said, you've got a Sangha retreat, why don't you come up? And I thought, yeah. And I was able to this year, so here I am at Dhanakosha on your Glasgow Buddha Centre Sangha retreat. And not only that, he said more things to me. He said, well, we're going to have a theme, do you want to give a talk? And I said, well, okay, yeah, I'll give a talk. And then he said, okay, the theme is the Theragata. And give a talk on one of the, sometimes they're called Songs of the Elders. So I said, right, okay. And I've read them before and they're pretty full on. I don't know if you've been reading any of the extracts that have been around, but they're pretty full on. They're really full on. These are early Buddhists that gained enlightenment. So they're not just messing around, as it were. They're not just tinkering around. They have a kind of hardcore, yeah. They've really gone profoundly deep in their practice. So I said, okay, I'll give a talk. And then I thought, well, who will I give a talk on? So I was reading through these Songs of the Elders. And the one that struck me was on Mahakashapa. So I'm going to talk on Mahakashapa. Yeah. And I think yesterday Surya Vangsar gave a proper talk. What I'm going to give today is possibly a bit more like a story. And so I was really pleased that he was talking about fairy stories yesterday. He was. He did say, you can check in the transcript, he talked about stories, and even fairy story was mentioned at one point. So I'm not sure if I'm going to tell a fairy story, but I'm going to tell a story. And it will be the story of Mahakashapa. And we'll hear some of his verses at the end. And as I'm talking, I was thinking, well, there's two types of truth. There is narrative truth and there's cognitive truth. Mostly in the West, we're very familiar with cognitive truth. Cognitive truth is what appeals to a rational mind. It's the truth of science. It's the truth of science. That's a good way of putting it. It's very cognitive, very rational. But there's also what's called narrative truth. A narrative truth is the truth of legend, of poetry. And, you know, if you've been out in the weather today, you might come back in and say, God, it was raining cats and dogs. And people will understand what you mean. But it wasn't literally raining cats and dogs. Yeah, yeah. So there is such a... This is a narrative truth. It's the poetic truth that conveys something, but it's not to be taken literally. So some of what I'll be talking about is probably actually happened. Some of what will be my maybe understanding of what may well have happened, and that will become apparent. So it's probably more in the realm of hagiography. So we think again in the West a lot about history, and we want to get facts and details. And this happened then, and that happened then, and then somebody did that, and they did it in that place, and they went to that place. And that does convey something. But again, more traditionally, in Buddhism, you often get hagiographies. And they are based on some historical events, but they're also conveying the feeling or the experience of what it was like that went on. So this is what hagiography is, and it's not about hags. It's not the biography of hags. It's conveying something more poetic, a combination of poetic truth and literal truth. Yeah, so this is what you get a lot in Buddhist texts. When you get a life of, say, a life of Padmasambhava, some of it probably actually happened, and and the rest of it happened, but it was as if it was like this. So it was as if this was what happened. Okay. So you're all sitting comfortably?
Yeah.
Good, good. So we're going to begin. I'm going to time travel. Yes, I'm going to tell you a story. So all stories happen kind of slightly in a different space. So we're going to do some travelling. So do sit tightly. And put your seatbelts on. So we're going to travel. We're going to travel back. We're going to do two types of travel. We're going to travel in time, and we're going to travel in space. And I've got Doctor Who's Gets TARDIS. Well, I can do one better, and I just use symbols. We're going to travel on sound. So we're going to travel, maybe not quite at the speed of sound, but we're going to travel in sound. Yeah. So as the sound goes, as the sound, the sound's going to be travelling. So we're going to travel with this sound. Yeah. And we're lifting off from Dhanakosha. You're all pretty safe. Don't wander off too far on your own. Yeah, stay with us. And where are we going? Well, we're going to go east. Yeah. So we're heading back in time and we're heading east. And we're still travelling. We're going back 10 years, 100 years further. We're going back 1,000 years. We're going back even further. Still possible. Might have to ring the bell again to get a bit further. We're going further back. We're going back 2,500 years. And we've found the place that we're going to. And this is a very flat land. Yeah. And as you familiarise yourself with it, you'll find that, yeah, it's quite flat. In the very far distance, you can see a sea. There's lots of green around, there's lots of forest around. And in the distance, there's also some mountains. And these mountains have got snow on top, so they're very high. Yeah, they're very high. And sometimes you know that there's a cold wind can come down off of those mountains. You can feel it on your skin. But there's three seasons in this land. There is the cool season, there's a hot season, and there's a rainy or monsoon season. And this land is called Magadha. And this land is also called India. Yeah, so we know it as India. In the past, people knew it under different names, but we'll call it Magadha. So we're back there 2,500 years ago. There is lots of people are living in villages. There is kings ruling over lands. There is lots happening. So some if you went to Village India today, you'd probably see something very similar. So we've travelled back 2,500 years ago, and we'll begin to hear the cry of a newborn baby. You're just born, and even back in India they used to spank you in your bottom just to check you had a good pair of lungs. And he's beginning to cry. It's a young boy, and his father and mother are both present. Well, the mother's always present, but the father's present as well. Yeah. But the father's there as well. They're both very proud, they're both very happy, they've had a newborn son. Yeah, so the mother's exhausted but very happy, and the father's kind of beside himself. He's got a son, fantastic. He's got an heir to his throne, because this is maybe not quite a king, but he thinks he's a king. He owns 16 villages. So I don't know what size the villages are. Maybe you can imagine better than I can, but he's the owner of 16 villages. So, I don't know, that could be quite a big bit of land. And anyway, this particular man is very wealthy. Yeah. And he feels like, well, maybe if it was Scotland, he might think he was the clan chief. But he's in India, so he's a Raja, he's a king. He feels himself to be a king. He's very happy that he's got a son. And his mother is very proud that she's got somebody that she can bring up, somebody that she can dote on and love and bring up. So they're both very happy. And, so things progress in this young boy's life. He begins to grow older and his character begins to form. We begin to get to see that this young lad has a character. And his character is that, well, he's quite a happy child. Yeah, he's bright, he's happy, and he's very contented on his own. He's happy just doing stuff on his own. So his parents sometimes think, well, maybe I'll need to get in some playmates. We're not sure if he's got any brothers or sisters, but he's quite happy. He's happy on his own. He's quite bright. And he goes through his early years. and he goes into his teenage years, and this character just begins to, this just seems something quite special about him. I'm sure you've all probably met somebody that you just think inside there's just something quite blessed about this particular person. And so this young boy, and he's got a name, his name is Kashyapa, so he just seems inside very happy, very bright, very contented. And yeah, his father's the king of all these 16 villages. His mother's very, very proud. And especially as you get into teenage years, you know, you, those of you that are parents probably know this, the teenage years are a bit more difficult between parents and children. So it seems like there's a bit of tension. And it's a bit unusual tension in this particular family. Because here we have Kashyapa, very bright, very happy. Happy to spend time on his own. Loves where he's living because he can quite easily get out into the jungle. He can get out into the wilderness and just really enjoy the beauty of the natural world around him. But there's a bit of tension. And the tension is that his father wants Kashyapa to become like him. His father wants Kashyapa to grow up and to take on the 16 villages. But Kashyapa's not really that interested. Kashyapa's much more interested in sort of leaving a worldly life. So there's a bit of tension in the household. So, you know, his father is, you know, just trying to give him all the things that he thinks he would want. So he's dragging him down to the iShop saying, do you fancy an iPhone? Do you know, do you want the iPads are out now. The store's got iPads. And Kashyapa's saying, no, I don't really want one. His father's like, what do you want? And he says, oh, I'm just quite happy going off and wandering. You know, just leave me be. I'm just quite happy. And his mother, he's in his teenage years. And his mother has sort of been doting on him and seeing him going off up, playing on his own and being quite happy on his own and thinking, is there something wrong with my boy? He's not chasing after women. And he's not. So she's like, why don't you get yourself a girlfriend? And he said, nah, I don't really want a girlfriend, I'm just quite happy as I am. So there's a wee bit of tension. Yeah, the parents can't really quite understand him. They're really into, his father's really happy that he's in charge of 16 villages, and he's proud that that's who he is. He's the Raja, he's the king of these 16 villages. He's got some status. He's got a place in the world because he's got this position. And his mother is very, she's a bit concerned because he doesn't really seem to be interested in girls. And so he's wondering, well, is he gay? And he's obviously not gay, but he's not interested in girls. So what's the thing? But he's just happy. He himself doesn't see it as a problem. But his parents are a bit worried. So they're saying to him, well, come on, I'll buy you an iPod, you know, do you want to have a big birthday, birthday party for your 18th birthday? And he says, no, look, we'll just waste all that money. There's floods in Pakistan just over there. They're really short of water, they're really short of food. Send that money over there, buy them some water purifying, buy them some equipment so they can build wells and things like that. And his parents are like, what, you don't want a party? Yeah, but he said, no, I'll go and do something more worthwhile with it, you know. This party will be over and I'll be a bit meaningless. We'll get together, we'll eat lots of food, and afterwards we're a bit bloated. But you know, we could do a lot more with that money than just waste it in a party. So things like that are going on, and there's a bit of tension there. Yeah, so his parents are quite worldly in a way, very successful in what they're doing, and they've got this son who just doesn't really play the same game, and they're a bit concerned. So they're badgering him all throughout his teenage years. Oh, you know, take on, become the king, look after all the properties, learn how to do it. You know, his father's very proud and, you know, he's got all these villages that they're in charge of. And the mother keeps saying, well, you need to get married. And his dad says, you know, son, your mother's right. You know, she's always right. You need to just do what your mum says. Get married. You know, it's a similar story all over the world. You've got to do what your mother tells you. But he thinks, oh, forget married. I'm going to end up caught up, a bit like my father is, spending all my time going from here to there, doing all these official duties, and I don't really want to do that. I want to go off. I want to learn to meditate. I want to leave the world. I want to find what's really valuable. But they keep on at him. So he finally decides that he's going to give in. But he's going to try and do it in his terms. He said, okay, well, listen, I will get married, but only on one condition. And I'll tell you this condition tomorrow. So he goes away and he moulds a figure of a female. So all the curves, beautiful face, and dresses the figure up in all the silks, and he hands this beautiful image of a female to his mother and father, and says, well, listen, if you can find a woman who is as beautiful as this image, then yes, I'll marry her. So he hands over the image, and he's not quite sure if he's done the right thing, but he thinks they'll never be able to find anybody as beautiful as this. So his parents are, right, okay. So they get the men on the job. So, right, we've got a task for you. 8 top guys, come in. Okay, you've got to search the land for this beautiful woman. Our son will only marry this woman that looks like this. Or this is your task. And you don't have a choice. This is what you've got to do. Yeah, go and find this. Go and find this woman. And so it's a bit like the Cinderella. Somebody was talking about Cinderella the other day. Instead of having a slipper, they've kind of got the image. So they've got this image, and, you know, they think, oh, okay, this is you and me, but let's go and find this woman. So they go off, and they're looking around the countryside, and lo and behold, they're told that there is a really beautiful woman in one of the villages. And they think, well, I wonder if this is the one. I wonder if this is the one. And they go and they find that she looks just like the figure that Kashyapa has modelled. And they talk to the parents and they say, okay, we're the Brahmins that we work for the king of these 16 villages, and he sent us on a mission. And he's looking for a beautiful daughter to marry his son, who will become the king. And the parents that he's talked to, oh, that's funny, we've got a lovely daughter, but she's refusing to marry anybody. She says she just wants to leave and go and join her, have a leave the worldly life. So he said, oh, brilliant, this is sorted. So a wee bit of arranged marriage goes on, and Kashyapa and Bada, this is the young princess's name, Bada, the beautiful princess, they are arranged to be married. And they're both not sure about this arranged marriage. They're thinking, well, I'd really like just to go off and leave a worldly life. You know, rather than getting more into it, I want to leave it. So they think, oh, I better do the right thing and write to this person and tell them what I'm like. So they both have the same thought, and they write a letter. No texts in those days. So they write a letter and fold it up, give it to the... I don't even know if there was a post. Was there a post? We don't even know if there was post, but there was letters, and the letters are going, the rest are crossing over, and the parents are quite fly. They think, okay, they're not in, they want to leave the worldly life, we better make sure that nothing happens. So they're intercepting the mail, so they intercept the mail, and they say, ah, letter, don't want to do this, ah, change it round, letter, do want to do this. So they switch the letters, and different letters go. So the marriage goes ahead. So these parents are quite crafty. They know a thing or two. So the marriage goes ahead. And as Bada and Kashyapa meet and get to know each other, they both introduce themselves and say what they're like. But they do, they're as good. They do communicate, saying, well, listen, okay, I'm doing this a bit under forced, what's the next thing that would go with that? I'm doing this under pressure. Yeah. And but really what I want to do is I want to kind of leave this behind, and I would rather go off into the jungle. And they both begin to realise that they're both of the same heart. They say, oh, that's funny, that's what I want. And did you not get my letter? And I said, no, but did you not get my letter? No. Well, I wonder what happened there. You know, so they're both beginning to understand that I said they're coming into this marriage, but they're not. They're really under their parents' pressure. So they do get married, but they make a vow that they're not going to consummate their marriage. And they wonder, well, how are we going to do this? Young man, young woman, bed together. Now, when I gave this talk before, I said at this point, well, you know what it's like when push comes to shove? I couldn't think of anything. But, you know, you've got a young man and a young woman in a bed together. Well, you know, what's going to follow? So what they decide is they decide that they are going to have a garland of flowers down the middle of the bed. So they put a garland up. Yeah, you may well shake your head. you put a garland of flowers down the middle of the bed, and that's there to remind them of what they really want to do with their lives. Because they kind of realise, well, okay, it might be quite nice, a night of fun, or a few nights of fun, but then if we want to be going off and leading the world of life, we won't be able to do that if we've got children. You know, we want to bring our kids up. You know, we want to look after them, we want to provide for them for all those years. So we'd be putting off for many, many years what we really want to do. So we think, well, we better not get to push comes to shove. So let's keep the flowers there. And it works. Yeah, it works. It's a story. This is what the story says. A garland. So if you're ever in any... if you're in a tight spot, a garland of flowers. It works every time. So the years begin to unfold. They're married young. Bada's 16. Kash was 20 when they get married. And they're living together. They're living there with Kashyapa's parents, and he's looking after his 16 villages. Probably quite busy. You need to get on your 4x4 to get round them all. But the parents die, and Kashyapa and Bada take on the responsibility. They take on they're quite responsible people. You know, they are very ethical and realise, well, we've got a responsibility to run the estate well for the people that are working here. So they take on the course of looking after the estate, the 16 villages, and they do it very well. They're very good at it. And so it happens that one sort of harvest time, Kashyapa's out in the fields overseeing the replowing of the fields ready for the next season. And as he's watching the plough and the ploughshare going through the ground, he's seeing the earth getting turned over, and as the earth's getting turned over, he's seeing the worms and all the different insects that are, their beds are being disturbed, a bit like a certain famous Scots poet who saw the very same thing. And but he also sees that following the plough and the ploughshare are all the birds, and the birds are getting their meal from the insects that are disturbed by the plough. He's quite disturbed at this kind of carnage. He's got quite a sensitive heart, and he sees the all the insects just being eaten by the birds that are following the plough, and he's quite disturbed at this. And he turns to somebody and says, "This is awful. This is whose karma is this? All this carnage, all these disturbed lives, all these lives that have been taken, being killed. Whose karma is this going to be?" And the man who's the ploughman is looking up and says, "Well, it's you. You're the boss. You're in charge of the 16 villages. You're in charge of the state. This is your karma, I'm afraid." And Kash was really deeply disturbed by this. He thinks, "Oh, didn't quite realise that." Well, that's so. He's just quite. So it's a bit like a Sam Vega arises. Yeah. So he says, "Oh my goodness, I need to do something about this. This is awful. All this suffering. I can't really bear it. You know." Can't really bear it. Meanwhile, at home, at the same time, the sesame harvest has come in, and Bada is overseeing the sesame harvest. And as the seeds are laid out to dry in the hot sun, all the insects are attracted by the smell and by some food. Again, they've been eaten by the other flock of birds that know that this is going to be happening. So she's witnessing carnage back at home. And she's also deeply disturbed and thinking, "My goodness, all this killing, all this suffering, whose karma is this going to be?" And she turns to her lady maid and says, "Well, all this suffering that's happening here, whose karma is this? Who's going to bear this karma?" And the lady's maid turns as well Bada, you're the queen of all this estate. This is your karma. And it really hits home to her. Oh, my goodness, all this suffering, and I'm going to bear this. So again, that kind of samvega arises of this just is not. There's got to do something about this. Got to do something about this. So Kashyapa returns, and they're talking when they both return back home, and they're sharing their day. And they both realise that they want to do something about this, and they want to go forth. This is now time to leave their worldly life. They've followed their parents' and wishes and instructions, but really they can't bear it any longer. Their will to live a less worldly life is so strong that they've got to do something about it. So what they do is they send some servants down to the bazaar, and they ask them to come back with some yellow robes and two begging bowls. So they send down to the bazaar. So a bit odd, that, isn't it? Bring me two robes and two begging bowls. We're leaving. So that's what happens. You know, the servants bring back the robes, and these are the robes of the wandering mendicants, the sadhus that were just wandering in India. That would signify that you're a sadhu. And they've got the begging bowls as well. So they decide that they're going to head off. The next day they head off, dressed in their wondrous robes with their begging bowls slung over their shoulder. And they shave each other's head, just as that last mark of kind of going forth. They shave each other's hair off, and that's them. They're on their way. And they set out, and they're leaving behind their estates, and The people that are working on the estate are very upset, because they think, well, who's going to run the estate? And Kashyapa says, well, I'm just leaving it in your hands. And those that were slaves, he had set free. He says, well, now's the time. You're now free. You're now free people. But they're both determined that they're going to leave. So they leave, and they go forth on the wandering life. So this is the life of a sadhu, where you just don yellow robes and get your... you partake of the wealth of the country and the countryside just by begging, and the people support you to do that. So they are going forth, and as they're wandering about, they're kind of thinking about what they're doing and the life that they've chosen, and they kind of begin to realise that she's still a young, beautiful woman. He's a young man, and they're thinking, tongues are going to be wagging. You know, okay, so we've kind of gone forth from the household life, but people won't really believe us. This is going to create a lot of difficulty for ourselves if we say that we've kind of gone forth from the household life, but we're wandering around still as man and woman. I don't know if they were still using the garland of flowers, but they would just realise that actually this is going to cause us a lot of difficulty, and it's going to create a lot of unnecessary. Anyway, bad karma for those that are going to gossip about us, because although we haven't, you know, we are just still platonic, and people will not believe that, and so they'll gossip about us, and it'll be bad for us, and it'll be bad for them, because they'll be gossiping. So they sadly realise they're going to have to part. And there's some suggestions in this story that for many lifetimes they have been involved together. And so this is a really difficult decision for them, because they're very deeply fond of each other, but they realise that they're going to have to go their different ways. It just won't work because of the culture that they're in. It just won't work. So Bada says to Kashyapa, okay, I think we are going to have to split. We have to go our separate ways, at least for the meantime. So when we come to the next fork in the road, please, you take the right-hand fork and I'll take the left-hand fork. And when we split, it'll be very sad. But that'll be us for the meantime. You know, we'll have to do that. So they come to the next fork in the road, and sadly, Bada goes down the left-hand road, or the left-hand path. And that's another story for another time, our story is going to follow Kashyapa down the right-hand road. So Kashyapa follows the right-hand path. I don't think there's any significance in that. Sometimes in the Tantra you get this left-hand Tantra, but this is pre all of that. Yeah. So, who else is on the scene apart from Kashyapa and Bada? Well, the Buddha. The Buddha is around. He has been at Nalanda, and he's in that vicinity. And when Bada and Kashyapa go their separate ways, it's such a spiritually momentous and important time that the earth trembles. It's not an earthquake. It's the ground is shaking because of the momentousness of the act that they're doing. And again, quite many times in the Buddhist tradition. So like when the Buddha gained enlightenment, it said that the earth trembled in many different types of ways. And that was just to signify the momentousness of that occasion. So when Bada and Kashyapa separate, it's a very spiritually momentous occasion, very deeply profound, and the earth trembles. And the Buddha's down that right-hand fork, funnily enough, and he senses the earth trembling, and he knows that why this is trembling, and he realises that something deeply spiritually important has been happening. So he decides that he's going to set off in that direction. So the Buddha sets off down this road from the other direction from where Kashyapa's going. And the Buddha gets so far and he decides it's time for a rest and finds a fig tree, we're told, and as was his wont on many occasions, he sits under a fig tree and he's sitting there waiting and because he knows that somebody's going to come along this road. And then Kashyapa appears, new robes, new begging bowl, striding out, and Kashyapa sees the Buddha, and Kashyapa realises, he sees the sort of spiritual brilliance of the Buddha, and the Buddha just sitting there, as you do, sort of under your fig tree, and waiting for your disciple to arrive. And Kashyapa senses that this is somebody that's really special, so Kashyapa approaches the Buddha, and as he approaches, just begins to realise there's something more and more special about this person the closer he gets to him. It's probably not long after the Buddha's enlightenment, so there's really still something quite major in the Buddha's demeanour and in his aura. If you could see his aura, it would have been an enlightened aura. So there's just a lovely presence about the Buddha, and Kashyapa approaches the Buddha and proclaims that this, from now on, I'm taking you as my teacher. The Buddha doesn't get to say yay or nay. No, he doesn't have a year to make his mind up. He has to respond very quickly, and he probably sees that actually this is some cool geezer. This is somebody who is actually really going for it. Yeah. So he responds to Kashyapa, says, "Yes, fine, I will take you on as one of my disciples. I will be your master. But I'm going to give you a teaching. Yeah, I'm going to give you a teaching. I don't know if this is what happened between Gunasiddhi and Dhanabhadri, but this is what happened between the Buddha and Kashyapa. So the Buddha sees Kashyapa, and Buddha was very astute, I think, with his perception of people. And he sees Kashyapa and he thinks, well, what will be of benefit? What can I say that will be of benefit to Kashyapa? So what he says is that, yes, Kashyapa, you can become my disciple. Do become part of my Sangha. But I'm going to give you three teachings. And he says, the first teaching that I'll give you is that always maintain a keen sense of shame and of wrongdoing towards all others in the Sangha. So the Buddha probably says something about Kashyapa's demeanour and sees that this is somebody who is of quite an upper class background, but don't allow that to get in the way of your relationships with others in the Sangha. Don't bring a haughty manner into your dealings with others in the Sangha. So be aware of acting appropriate towards all others in the Sangha. The second teaching that he gives them, he says, the second teaching that I'm going to say to you is, Well, anything, any Dharma that you hear or listen to it with an open mind. And if you find it to be worthwhile, then just let it absorb into your heart. Be as wholehearted as you can about receiving this teaching. And Kashyapa probably thinks, yeah, that's not a problem. I'm very happy to do both of those things. And then the Buddha says, and there's a third thing I'm going to say to you, the third teaching. And this third teaching is, he says, well, as you're practicing, you'll be practicing mindfulness of your body. But as you're practicing mindfulness of your body, don't forget, don't neglect the gladness of your heart that's linked with that practice. So yeah, be mindful, get really into your meditation practice, but don't forget, don't neglect the gladness. Yeah. So all that's fine. Kashyapa's very happy to take on these teachings. The Buddha's very happy to take Kashyapa as his disciple. And so they carry on their journey. And they're walking along, they're walking back towards, actually it's back towards Rajagriha. Rajagriha's it's termed a mountain, but I don't know, I'm told that, well, in Indian terms it's a mountain, but it's not that high. It's about 500 feet, yeah, so it's not really, but it's a mountain for them. So, but they're heading back to the Mount of Rajagriha. And they stop to have a rest, and Kashyapa's very respectful towards his new teacher, so he takes off his robes and he folds it up, takes off his new robes and puts them down on the ground so that the Buddha can sit on them, so the Buddha can have a seat. And the Buddha sits down and says, oh, that's very comfy, that's really nice, thank you very much. You know, it's quite pleasant, very nice of him to do that. And Kashyapa senses, God, my robes are really soft, but the Buddha has just got these old rags sewn together. So he thinks, Buddha, I'd like, why don't we swap? Why don't you have my robes, my nice new soft robes, and I'll take on your robes, your rags that you've put together. And the Buddha says, are you sure? You know, are you sure you can wear these hempen worn out rag robes of mine? And Kashyapa says, yeah, I can actually, I want to. So it's quite significant that this last almost vestige of his position Kashyapa gives away, and he takes on the old rag robes of the Buddha and is very happy to wear them. And the Buddha just takes Kashyapa's robes. Yeah, that's fine for him. So this is the story of Kashyapa and the Buddha meeting. And it's said that Kashyapa within 7 days gained enlightenment. So he was a fast mover, and he did remarkably well. So to gain enlightenment in 7 days. And as his life unfolded, Kashyapa carried on with with his intention to lead a very simple life. And he became very well known, very renowned for his meditation, and very renowned for his austerities, actually. Yeah, he was very keen to practice a simple life so that he didn't get caught up unnecessarily in anything else. And Buddhists are allowed 13 Dutanga practices. This is a list of them if anybody wants to practice them for the rest of the week. And Kashyapa became very well renowned for them. Yeah. It's said that he became foremost among the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis in regard to observing austerities. And when he was asked why he practiced these austerities, he said, well, I practice them because they're for my own well-being. Yeah. They bring me joy. And he also said, well, I also practice them to show that it can be done, and that I can be an example for future generations, that it is possible to lead a simple life, and not just a simple life, but a simple life that's full of gladness and joy. So also he was as good as his word, and he did remember the Buddha's teaching about remembering to foster and cultivate gladness in his heart while he was practicing his austerities and doing his meditation. So although he led a very simple life, his inner life was incredibly rich. His inner life was very joyful and very glad. So So the other, we're talking something about his life and qualities. So he's foremost among the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis in observing the simple life and the austerities. The next quality about Kashyapa is that it's said that he wouldn't do anything unbefitting a monk for the sake of robes, for alms food, for medicine, for anything at all, for house, somewhere to stay. He wouldn't really compromise his ethics. So he'd always take what came his way. So when the bhikkhus were wandering around, they'd have their bowl, and that's where they collected their food. And so you can imagine, or can you? I don't know if I can. Imagine just getting the food from having a bowl and wandering up and standing outside somebody's front door. And whatever comes your way, and that's what you eat. But that's, so you can imagine getting quite anxious about, well, am I going to get the curry that I like? You know, many veggie burgers today. You know, you just eat what comes your way. And if it's just a poor village, then you might just get rice. And if it's a poor village in hard times, you might not get anything. And this is what happened to those bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. They wouldn't always eat. But it said that Kashyapa would always just take this in good grace, and he wouldn't get upset. And if he didn't get a lot to eat, if he didn't get what he liked, then he would just take and eat what he got. And he wouldn't say anything to the... You know, you can imagine you're hungry, you get your bowl and you get a little bit of dal and a little bit of curry. You think, is that all you're going to give me? But because you're really hungry. But he said that it never crossed his mind, that it never even crossed his lips, any bad word, any frustrated or anxious or angry word. The third thing about Kashyapa that we're told is that he was exemplary in his meditation practice. So in Buddhist practice we have, often are talked about eight dhyanas. There's four dhyanas of form, and there's four formulas dhyanas. And the very profound meditation states. And it's said that Mahakashyapa, as it went on, he became known as Mahakashyapa. It's said that Mahakashyapa was only second to the Buddha in his ability to go deeply in meditation. And through his practice of meditation, it's said that he developed six supernormal knowledges. So Suryavansa mentioned three of these yesterday. So there was, if you meditate deeply, you can get six supernormal knowledges. So I'll tell you about them, because it might inspire you to go and sit there in your meditation. The first one is that you get magical powers. Yeah, whoa, what about that then? Eh? Yeah, you get magical powers, and you get the ability to walk through walls. How cool is that? Yeah. You can walk in water. You can sit there and manifest another image of yourself. So there can be two or three of you around. And who's to know that some of us aren't already doing that? Eh? So some of us might be on a retreat and down in Glasgow having a high life. Right. So you can manifest different. That's one of the cities. That's one of the magical powers. That's one of the first abhinyas, they're called, or abhinyas, six supernormal knowledges. But that's quite mundane, actually. Yeah, you don't really want to just stop there. You know, you might be able to impress your friends at a party, but there's further you can go. The second one is clairaudience, so you can hear things at a distance. The third one is that you can tell people's mind. So you can tell what state of mind somebody's in. And this used to really freak me out when I first came along to the Buddhist movement. I thought, oh my God, they're going to know what's in my mind, you know. Because I'd heard about this ability of people to read minds. And, oh no. And then it was a great relief to find out that they couldn't. Then it was a great trauma to begin to find that I had to tell people what was on my mind. So, so that's the third abhinya, is that you know what's on people's mind. You know if it's a mind of greed or hatred or delusion, you can tell. Yeah. But when we get onto the fourth super knowledge, that's when it begins to get a wee bit more interesting. believe it or not. And that a super Surya Master said yesterday, you begin to recollect former lives. So we're moving now from just sort of pretty mundane abilities, pretty cool abilities, but still quite mundane, into something that is beginning to be of the nature of insight. So you're beginning to see that in a former life you were so-and-so and you lived so-and-so and you did this. And you just see back and back that you've had there's been a whole stream of lives. So who you are is just beginning to be thrown into a much, much bigger context. And the fifth knowledge is what they call divine eye. And that means that you can see where you go, what your future, what lies in your future. And the deva eye is said to be able to see where you're going in the future. And you also understand that independence of what you do now, that's what gives rise to your future. So what you're doing in your present is creating your future. So that's the deva eye. So those two are linked around condition co-production. So it's a big bit like you can begin to really see that everything that's arising and depends upon conditions. And the sixth supernormal knowledge is the knowledge of the destruction of the ashravas. So Suryavaksa again said a little bit about that yesterday. But that's the kind of realisation that capacity to act in any way unskillfully has completely just been rooted out. It's just gone. It's dissolved, as it were, in your consciousness. So those ashravas are no longer operate in your stream of consciousness, in your mind. So yeah, this is the third major quality about Mahakashyapa. He's renowned for his meditation experience and for his development of those supernormal knowledges. And one of the little stories that I like about Mahakashyapa is that on one occasion he was going through a village and there was a poor villager, poor female villager, and she saw this sadhu coming through her village and she just was able to see that there was something about this particular person that was very special. And I think we get that from time to time, that we think, oh, there's something really special, this person's got something. So this was female villager was experiencing, seeing a sadhu, and just thought, oh God, there's something about this person. And so she knew that he would be on his arms round, so she wanted to offer him, she wanted to support and be in whatever way she could part of what he was involved in. So she offered him some of the, she just had parched rice, we're told, so she offers him a little bit of parched rice. But she also makes the wish that whatever good this sadhu, this bhikkhu is involved in, could she also partake in. And the only way she's got, in a way, is giving some rice, but she gives some rice, and her giving is her way of getting involved, of being involved, of supporting this thing that she thinks of as quite special. And she gives that to Mahakashyapa. Mahakashyapa receives it. And as she's walking away, we're told that she comes across a poisonous snake who bites her and kills her. So she dies from the snake bite. But she she's reborn as a deva, as a devi, as a goddess, because of the skillfulness of that action, just as she was on the point of death. And she remembers how she had this very fortuitous birth. So then she sees, she's able with her deva eye to see Mahakashyapa sitting there meditating in his little hut, his little kuti. And she thinks, oh, there's that sadhu. So she comes down and for 3 days she cleans his hut and for 3 days replaces the water in his hut. And Mahakashyapa must be thinking, I thought I'd finished that water. And then it's miraculously refilled. But this is what the story relates, that this devi spent 3 days cleaning out his hut and replacing the drinking water and the washing water. But Mahakashyapa originally twigs, ah, there's a devi doing this. Don't know how he does it, but he does. And he asks her to leave because it wouldn't be appropriate for him as a, again as a renunciant that's gone forth to have a devi, a goddess, cleaning out his hut. It's just not appropriate. Can you imagine what the Sunday newspapers would say about it? So again, that's a lovely little story. And he has another encounter, not just this time with one goddess, but 500 goddesses see him, and they're so impressed by his spiritual life and what he's doing is that they want to come and offer him alms food. But as they approach, he sees them coming. He says, it's not appropriate for you to, it's not appropriate for me to receive my food from the gods, the goddesses. So I can't accept this. So he says he can't do it. It's not appropriate. So they go off and they're really disappointed. And there's different layers of gods and goddesses in the Indian mythology. And they're in the realm of Shaka, who's the chief of the gods. So he gets to hear what's going on and he thinks, wow, there's this guy sort of meditating. So Shaka, the chief of the gods, decides that he wants to go and give Mahakashyapa his food. He wants to give to him. So he disguises himself because he knows that Mahakashyapa won't accept food from a god. So he disguises himself and gives Mahakashyapa the food. And Mahakashyapa doesn't notice until he gets the rice. And the fragrance of the rice is just quite exceptional. He thinks, this is fragrant rice. And then he realizes, something, I've been played a trick upon here. And he tells off Shaka, the king of the gods, for inappropriately giving him alms food. So we're getting a picture. I mean, we can kind of laugh at it, but this is somebody who was quite serious about the practice and lived a very simple life, and in a way wanted to, in a way, show that, yeah, you could lead a very simple life, and not only would it be a simple life, but it'd be a really happy, it'd be a joyful life. Mahakashyapa was one of the main disciples of the Buddha, and there's possibly about five major disciples. In the telling that I heard, you have Mahamoggallana and Sariputra, and they die before the Buddha, but the Buddha dies before Mahakashyapa, and we're told that Mahakashyapa he's walking, he's on an alms tour with some of his disciples, and he's having an afternoon break underneath a fig tree, I guess, and he sees another sadhu walking past, and this sadhu is holding a mandarava flower. Yeah, so what's unusual about that? Fascinating.
Massive. Enormous. Yes,
it's a massive flower, and it's a flower that only grows where? Yeah, phone a friend. Hello, where do mandaravas grow? They grow in the Devalokas. Yeah. So they only appear in the Devalokas. They're a sort of magical flower, and said to be what, half a league across or something. Massive, massive flower. So I don't know how this. Maybe he's got it. Walking along with this mandarava flower, but Mahakashyapa realizes that something quite special has happened. So he turns to this sadhu and he says, "Where did you get that flower? And the sadhu says, "Well, I was over Kusinara, that's where the Buddha died." And he says, "I was over at Kusinara, and they're building a pyre for the Buddha, and that's where I picked it up." And so Kashyapa gets this sad news that the Buddha, his teacher, his beloved teacher, has died while he's separate from him. So he's really concerned that he's not going to be able to pay his last respects to his teacher. He's not in sorrow because he knows that everything's impermanent. Some of the people that he's with are really grief-stricken, but we're told that Kashyapa wasn't grief-stricken. But they makes their way back to Kusinara. And there's been a bit of trouble at Kusinara. And the trouble is that, they've built this pyre to cremate the Buddha, but they can't light it. It wasn't late. Get the matches out. It's not lighting. And this is after a week. So a week later, Kashyapa comes with his band of disciples. And they're very glad. They're very glad to be able to have got to say their goodbye and their last respects to the Buddha. And they circumambulate clockwise around the pyre of the Buddha. And they do that once, and then they go around again. And once they've all circumambulated that pyre twice, the pyre just spontaneously combusts. And that's the story as I've heard it, without adding anything into it or taking anything away. That's what I've been told. So that's what we're told happened. So that was Kashyapa's farewell to the Buddha. We're not sure how Kashyapa died. We're not told about how he died. But we know that he did outlive the Buddha, and that he was a very highly respected disciple of the Buddha. So, where does that leave us? So, it still leaves us 2,500 years ago in India. We've got to come back. Yeah. So we've got to come back to the present. We're coming back on... Is everybody with us? We haven't lost anybody. So we're back in Dhanakosha. It's 2010. It's 20 to 12. So here we have the story of Mahakashyapa, yeah. And I don't see anybody rushing off to Balwhidder to get their yellow robes and bowl. In a way, but what can we make of this? What can we make of this life story? It is of a different time, but it's trying to get something across. There's something I think that we can learn from this story. I think often we can think of taking up a spiritual life, and sometimes it can feel like, oh, it means letting go or stopping doing stuff. And sometimes there are things that we want to move on from and let go of. But there's also things that we want to pick up and make sure that we're practicing. So a bit like Mahakashyapa, yeah, he was leaving his worldly life, but his instruction from the Buddha was, don't forget to have a glad heart. Yeah. So this, I think, is really important. So some of the things that make us happy are somehow from the senses. So what can we do if we are living a more simple life? Then how do we maintain a glad heart? I mean, some of the things that are suggested in Sri Ratna are practices like puja, faith and devotion, meditation, study, puja, ethics, but also being around in nature, So we're very fortunate that we've got Dhanakosha, because it's so beautiful around here. There's so much nature. You step outside and there it is. Yeah, elements and the natural world in all its glory and beauty is really around us at Dhanakosha. But also friendship is something that's encouraged to keep our hearts alive and nourished, so that our hearts don't shrivel. So we might sometimes think, oh, I've got to let go of this and do that and do this. But we've got to watch that our hearts remain glad. Yeah. And I think especially, I suppose, in Scotland we've got this, we've got this Protestant tradition that part of that seems to be about letting go of things, live a simple life. But maybe it hasn't given a lot of attention to that sense of, well, yeah, if you live a simple life, also make sure you're living a glad life. So your heart is really thriving and flourishing. So now, just to finish with my beautiful assistant. So Buddhism talks about practicing a middle way, and that's a middle way between pleasure and asceticism. And one of the most maybe important insights of the Buddha was that you cannot afford just to deny yourself any pleasure. But the pleasures that you give yourself, what kind of come down afterwards do they have? do they lead you on, or do they, are they kind of, are they supportive of your spiritual life? So I think we cannot, we at our peril, do we neglect joy and pleasure? So where do we get that in our spiritual life? How do we get that? How do we follow a middle way between pleasure and asceticism? So how do you find your middle way? So are you more in this realm? Are you more hedonist? Or are you more an ascetic? Or do you more happily think, well, if I deny myself that chocolate biscuit today, I mean tomorrow I'll get some good karma coming. So where are you? Where do you kind of place yourself in this? Are you more an ascetic, or are you more a hedonist? And then if you are, well, how do you make your way more towards what's a middle way? And how do you gladden your heart? Sure, you like Sam. When I said, when he was writing these up for me, I said, and the second thing is, how do you gladden your heart? And it's the language might be a bit flowery, but I've been in England for 15 years, so you have to get it. So how do you gladden your heart? Yeah, I think it's a very important question, because we have to take that on. So I'll leave you with those two questions that maybe we can take into groups if we haven't finished with the questions from yesterday. So there you go.
Thank you very much.